I'm Christopher Lydon with a very different sort of historian, Ian Morris at Stanford University. He goes back to the last ice age to answer the East-West question that haunts a lot of our dreams. In short, are we toast? Does the rise of India and China mean the dustbin for us? What is the long score in this East-West World Series? How did it come to this? And why does Ian Morris toss out the year 2103, which is three generations or roughly a century away, as the moment when the East finally nails its great comeback? Ian Morris's remarkable book is titled Why the West Rules for Now. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. I got hooked on your questions, Ian Morris, wandering in India last summer, and then I read your book as we were all watching President Obama in Asia this month, pushing India for a permanent seat in the UN Security Council, a big adjustment. But he was getting stiff-armed around the same time by the Chinese. I'm wondering, is there a single scorecard for the news these days and your version of history unfolding?
Yeah, it was fascinating to watch President Obama's trip around Asia unfolding as this sort of rapturous reception he got in India and Indonesia. And then, of course, he gets up to South Korea and the story is very different there. Unable to convince the South Koreans to just go along with the changes in quotas that he wants. Unable to get the rest of the G20 to back him in his plans for global financial revival. And I think in many ways it's symptomatic of the changes that we're living through.
All against the complaint about, you know, is China going to be a manageable superpower? Is it outrageous for it to want to run the South China Sea and the neighborhood?
Yes, I think in a lot of ways what's happening with China now is very similar to what was happening with the U.S. 100 years ago. And 100 years ago, West Europeans were all complaining constantly about the rise of this great power across the ocean. That is how unsophisticated America was and how Americans threw their weight around and didn't understand how the world works. And this, of course, is very similar to what we now are saying in the U.S. about China. And the rapid rate of the growth in the economy in China, in a lot of ways, very similar to what was happening 100 years ago with the US. I think we're living through, as I keep saying in my book, I think you're just living through the latest stage in a very, very long process of shifting centers of power and wealth around the world.
So how far back do you want to go, Ian Morris, to see what's underway and then approach the question of how it ends?
This was sort of the question that led to me writing the book, in fact. There's been this huge debate among historians in the last 30 years about Western domination of the planet since the 19th century. The old view that Westerners thought of in the 19th century was that there's just something better about Westerners. And some would say it's the genetic, and some would say it's cultural or religious or political. But there's some factor about the West that goes back a long time into history that predetermined that the West was going to come to dominate the planet. But then the last 30 years or so, more and more historians started saying, no, this is complete nonsense. The similarities between the West and the East and other parts of the world hugely outweigh the differences right up till about the year 1800 when the Western Industrial Revolution took off. And it was really just an accidental kind of thing that there was no real reason why the West came out on top. And these arguments have been raging, like I say, for about 30 years. And my background is very much in the early periods of history, in archaeology and ancient history. And it seemed to me that a lot of the debate was really about the early periods, with some people saying that the West has been distinctive since very ancient times, others saying, no, it hasn't. And so I more and more felt that what you need to do is just take a very, very large-scale view of human history, looking at the whole planet, going back at least as far as the end of the last ice age, 15,000 years ago. And that is going to show you what the big patterns are.
And you show them. I mean, it's astonishing how much data you get in there. But give us the pattern.
Well, yeah, I spent a long time trying to work out what seemed to be going on in this very large-scale history of the world. I came to the conclusion eventually that there's really three things you need to know about to explain why the West came out to dominate the world in the 19th century. And the first of these was just biology, just what human beings are, which is basically clever chimpanzees. And that all human beings beings all over the world are pretty much the same. When you take people in large groups, they're pretty much the same everywhere you look, every period of history you look at. And once you know that, I think that automatically explains a lot of what goes on in human history at the very large scale, a lot of the direction societies take. And the second thing I realized you needed to know about was sociology and the sense of why it is that societies change in particular kinds of ways, why they sometimes resist change, why things sometimes break down altogether. And if you put these two things together, I think you get a pretty good general universalizing theory of history about why we've gone from a very small number of humans during the Ice Age who lived kind of on the edge of survival to a situation where now we've got 6 or 7 billion people extracting all this energy from the world, so much energy that we are threatening to destroy our own planet with it. So you get a very good general theory of the history of the world. But what it doesn't tell you is why some parts of the world have fared so differently from others, why some societies have become so rich and some have not. And to explain that, I think the third fact you need is geography. And this, I guess, kind of flows on, I think, logically from understanding the importance of biology and sociology. That if human beings and human societies are so similar around the world, then it kind of makes sense that the thing that will make them have different trajectories is the geographical settings they find themselves in. So this was the conclusion I came up with. Yeah, three big things really do explain the broad shape of human history.
These remind one, a reader of Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, of course, that it's all about location, location, location. He said that the human species is the same in its fundamental, same carburetor in the head all around the world ever since we left Africa. But you've added something to Guns, Germs, and Steel, and I'm not exactly sure what it is. It might be the motive energy or something, or the direction.
Yes, well, length is one thing. My book's a lot longer than his. but yeah, I mean, Guns, Germs, and Steel was a great influence on me when I was first thinking about some of the ideas that went into this book. I think it's one of the great books of the 1990s. And I think the great insight that Jared Diamond had was just to see that historians, because on the whole, historians don't have a lot of background in biology and biological evolution, partly as a result of that, they've tended to neglect the importance of geography. And so I think he was absolutely right about that, about the importance of geography. But he and I are asking slightly different questions. I think that's the main difference between the books here, that his book very famously begins with this story about a New Guinean friend of his named Yali, and they're walking on a beach together in New Guinea in 1972. And Yali says to Jared, why is it that the white guys have got all of this stuff, right, and we black guys here in New Guinea, we don't have any stuff? And so in Guns, Germs, and Steel, he tried to answer Yali's question and said, well, you need to look back thousands of years, and you'll see if you do that, that the first complex societies arose because of geographical reasons in the Northern Hemisphere. And so because this was where the story of complex societies began, the Northern Hemisphere has continued to dominate the world's wealth and power. And that answers Yali's question. And I think that it really does pretty much answer the question. I think he was absolutely right about this. But it doesn't answer another set of questions. And this was the questions I wanted to focus on. That you know, if you're my friend, you'll say my questions are more focused than Jared Diamond's. And if you're my enemy, you'll say they're narrower than Jared Diamond's. But what I ask in this book is, within the Northern Hemisphere, why is it that by 1800, it's the societies at the western end of Eurasia and their overseas colonists, particularly in North America, why do those societies, rather than the ones at the eastern end of Eurasia, come to dominate the planet in the 19th and 20th centuries? And then having tried to answer that question, I then say, well, once we've answered that question, can we go on and project the answers forward to see where things are going to go in the next 100 years? So I think I agree with Jared Diamond on more things than we disagree about. But the two books are asking rather different questions.
Coming up to 1800, in the modern era, shall we say, it's only recently that the West has caught up with China. I mean, Marco Polo thought he was in a kind of tech heaven when he got to China.
Yes.
But then they contracted. They did not send their explorers out, their versions of Christopher Columbus. It was the West that expanded. And then, like a shot going off, when Britain figured out steam and factories and big guns, the contest, in a certain sense, was over. It didn't have to happen exactly that way. But remind us, why did the West pull away so decisively in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries?
Yes, I think this in some ways is kind of the central question for anybody interested in this problem. And I argue in the book that it's not because of Western geniuses or superior genetics in the West or Western religions or anything like that. That it's, once again, just the outcome of the changing meanings of geography and history. When you look at the world, you look at Western Europe, through most of human history, Western Europe has really been a backwater. It's been a geographical backwater. It's sticking out into the cold, rainy North Atlantic Sea and North Atlantic Ocean. It's a long way from the real centres of innovation in the western end of the world, down in the Mediterranean Sea, where you've got the great empires developing, great scientific and philosophical breakthroughs happening there. Northwest Europe is always on the peripheries. Now, this changes dramatically after about the year 1400. And it changes because East Asia, throughout what Europeans think of as the Middle Ages, East Asia has been very much the center of the world in terms of wealth and power and innovation and creativeness. East Asians are the richest people on Earth. They've been generating all kinds of new inventions. And these inventions have been spreading out across the world because they're such good inventions. And as they spread out, they dramatically change the meaning of geography. And there's two inventions in particular that I'm thinking of here, which come along in China in the 12th, 13th centuries. And one of these inventions is ocean-going ships, where you can reliably get in one of these boats and sail for thousands of miles, get somewhere, and then come back again. And, you know, of course, everybody loves this. These things spread relatively quickly, within a century. The techniques you need to do this are spread all the way across Eurasia. And the second of these inventions is guns that work. The Chinese have figured out how to use gunpowder, how to make it explode in a metal barrel fast enough to fire a projectile out of the end of the barrel. And the oldest known proper gun in the world dates to 1288, found in Manchuria in northeast China. By 1328, so just 40 years later, we see illustrations in manuscripts in Florence and Oxford showing enormously superior versions of guns that have spread across the whole of Eurasia in just 40 years. It's like everybody loves ships and guns. And once you've got ships and guns, something very dramatic happens, because now you can start sailing across the oceans, and when you get to the other side of the oceans, you can kill the people who live there, which is, you know, hugely attractive proposition to all kinds of people in Eurasia. A fact about geography that has been a fact forever, basically, now suddenly becomes very important. And this fact is that Western Europe is only about 3,000 miles from the Americas, whereas East Asia is about 6,000 or 7,000 miles from the Americas, with the prevailing winds and tides you have to use to get to the Americas. Now, the new ships allow people to sail across the oceans. Before about 1400, these geographical facts simply didn't matter, because nobody can cross the ocean, so who cares how far it is to the Americas. After 1400, though, all of a sudden, people from Eurasia can cross the oceans and go to the Americas. And I suggest in my book that given time, other things being equal, East Asians would have sailed to the Americas and colonized the Americas. East Asians would have breathed their germs on the native population and wiped it out. East Asians would have plundered the Americas and created a new kind of economy. But because Western Europe is only half as far from the Americas, thanks to the changed meanings of geography, it's Western Europeans who do all these things. And Spanish conquistadors go out there, breathe on the natives, wipe them out. People in Northwest Europe begin to create new kinds of market economies around the shores of the North Atlantic Ocean. Europeans are the ones who find that if they can just understand properly how the winds and the tides work, if they can just understand astronomy properly, the benefits that will flow from this are enormous. And this, I suggest, is why it's Europeans rather than Chinese or Indians or Arabs who begin having a scientific revolution in the 16th and the 17th centuries, because the benefits of understanding nature that accrue to Europeans are so much higher than the benefits that accrue to people in other parts of the world. So people in other parts of the world are just as smart as Newton and Descartes, but they have different reasons, different questions are being thrust on them by the changing meanings of geography. So I suggest in my book that it's really geography and the way geography changes its meanings as development increases that explains why it was the West rather than some different part of the world that came to have new kinds of economies, new questions about science, and basically goes on to dominate the world.
I want to push back on the general notion of history as if people were clever chimps, as you say. But first, would you just outline your completely fascinating to me index of social development, basically putting a number on the complexity of communities, human communities, going back thousands and thousands of years, and then watching them change. Energy consumption, for example, or size of communities. Your book dazzled me with the degree to which these numbers that we live in today are completely unprecedented, even just in the last relatively few years in our lifetimes.
Yeah, well, when I started reading around this subject and thinking about maybe writing this book, one of the things that struck me most forcefully was how when you looked at the different kinds of theories out there, these ones that say there's something distinctive about the West going back into ancient times, or alternatively, ones that say there's nothing distinctive about the West until very, very recently, the thing that struck me most about them was how often people seem to be talking past each other. They were focusing on different bits of history, using different methods, assuming different things are important, and often just not connecting up at all in their arguments. And it reminded me, in fact, very much of the famous story about the five blind men and the elephants, where one guy gets a hold of the tail and says it's a rope, and another guy grabs a tusk and says it's a spear. So I started to feel that what we need is some way to make the different people having this argument, make them all get on the same page and talk about the same things. And again, this, I think, comes probably largely from the archaeological background. But it seemed to me the obvious way to do this is something numerical. And the great advantage of a numerical approach to measuring things is not so much that it makes you be objective, because you still have to make lots and lots of subjective assumptions and decisions about what you're measuring and how you do it. But it does force you to be very explicit. And if you say the answer to this question is 43 or something, and somebody else says, no, it's 47. In order to make these claims, you have to be able to say what you're measuring, why you're measuring it, why you're assigning particular scores to it. So I felt that the big thing was to have some way to make things more explicit. I thought a long time about just what is it that we're talking about when we ask a question like, why does the West dominate so much of the world today? I mean, nobody thinks that Western governments get their way in absolutely everything they do, as witnessed by President Obama's recent experiences. But yet we also, it's very clear that Western governments today have way more power in the world than they did, say, 1,000 years ago. So what is it we're actually talking about? I decided that I should be focusing on the concept that I call in the book social development, which basically is just a society's ability to get things done in the world, to master the intellectual and physical landscape it lives in, to impose its will on the world around it, to extract things from the world. And this is something that's eminently measurable. And I took the inspiration for actually doing the measuring from an index that the United Nations has called the Human Development Index, which I'm sure a lot of people are already familiar with. But basically, they wanted to find a way to measure how well different governments around the world are doing in creating situations that allow the citizens of those countries to realize their innate human potential. So the UN economists said, okay, we want to measure this, and there's potentially an infinite number of things we could try to measure. But what we want to do is strip it down to the smallest possible number of traits that we can look at that still cover roughly what it is we mean by human development. So they said there's three things, and if we measure these three things, this will give us a ballpark estimate of human development. And their three things were years of education, life expectancy, and lifetime earnings. And these are things that are all very quantifiable, and every year the UN publishes a new version of their Human Development Index. So it seemed to me this was the kind of thing I wanted to do. And although the actual thing I'm measuring, social development, is of course pretty different from human development. So I came up with an index with four variables rather than three. One of them is per capita energy capture, how much energy a society is drawing out of its environment. One of them was the organizational level of the societies and how good they are at just getting stuff done. One of them, the third of them, was information technology, how good is a society at processing and storing the information that it's able to generate about the world. And then the last one, sadly, not the least of them, is war-making capacity, because I think any attempt to measure social development in the sense I'm talking about, the ability of a group to use violence to protect itself or impose its will on others, this does have to be a part of it. And these things, they're difficult to measure. There's all kinds of controversy and debate about measuring them. But I think we can measure them accurately enough, at least for what I'm doing, over the 15,000 years or so since the end of the Ice Age. So yeah, this is kind of the backbone of the book. And on my website, I've got a 75,000 word ebook that you can download free of charge if the mood should take you, which gives you all the background on how I did these calculations.
Yeah, but it's the numerical measures themselves that I just want to resist. In what the story leaves out, in a word, is people. And it's not just heroes and villains, you know, whether it's Hitler or Jesus or Muhammad or Caesar or Pericles, but it's all those social ideals that we grow up thinking make history, including liberty, equality, fraternity, or nationalism, or art and culture. But it's also maybe the bad things that we say drive history too, when we say that history is a nightmare from which we're trying to awake, or when William James said in despair, history is a bucket of blood starting with the Iliad, and it's about time we did something about it. Where does the, not just the great people, but humanity itself figure in driving this story?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, one which I thought about a lot as I was writing the book. And very interesting, I found that my assumptions about this were changing as I went on and writing this book. And I think this is one of the really interesting consequences of backing up from the details, the stuff that historians normally focus on. Yeah? I think that really does change your perspective on the way that history works. And in particular, I was struck by the enormous similarities you see between societies at similar stages of social development. We were just talking about the social development index. But you know, as you move from, say, the Ice Age world of hunter-gatherer societies up to modern post-industrial societies, as you do this, you look around the world at these different kinds of societies, and say you look at the hunter-gatherer societies. There are great differences between hunter-gatherers in Africa and hunter-gatherers in the Arctic region, say. But in certain ways, the similarities between them are also very, very striking. Like, say, hunter-gatherer societies tend to have very low levels of class inequality, very low levels of gender inequality. When you move from hunter-gatherer societies to farming societies, peasant societies all over the world have tremendous similarities. The gender inequalities increases enormously. You get roughly the same kind of gender division of labor between men and women in peasant societies all over the world. You get the rise of the first large-scale forced labor systems in these societies, because it's very difficult to get things done above a family level unless you use compulsion to make other people do things for you. And the similarity, say, between ancient agrarian empires, the similarities hugely outweigh the differences. Then if you sort of move on further with social development, when you start to get industrial societies, once again, the similarities are really very striking around the world. In some ways, economic inequality increases even further. The very rich in industrial societies are just, you know, off-scale rich. But the political inequalities between people start to decline because more democratic societies simply function better in the 20th century. And this, of course, is one of the great things we learned in the 20th century. We also see a collapse of gender inequalities. And of course, there's still great differences between male and female lifestyles. But compared to what you get in the typical peasant society, nowadays, gender inequalities in particularly in the richer countries are becoming much more limited. And I think when you back up from the details, you do see these very, very striking similarities between societies. And this made me think very much as I was writing the book about, you know, what is the role of individuals and free will in history? I ended up in a position very different from the one I started the book in. And it seemed to me that by the end of the book, that while obviously everybody has free will, you get up in the morning and I decided which socks to put on this morning and all kinds of decisions I made. I decided which cab to get into to go off to the airport this morning. I made all these decisions. This was complete free will. I could have done radically different things. But if I were a historian in the future writing a book called Why the West Rules for Now, the decisions that I made this morning would not feature in the book. Because basically those decisions, while they affected me, they didn't affect the answers to this question. And this was what I found about almost everything that you could look at that you would say this was driven by the decisions of some individual person. The decisions of very large numbers of people are decisive in world history, but those are being driven by much more basic forces of biology, sociology, and geography.
One was reminded of sort of seeing thousands and thousands of spiders' webs by different kinds of spiders all over the world, and noting that there are patterns here. What does a spider do? Well, it makes a web, and you can see the resemblances and the connections. But I also wonder, you know, in human history, where do ideas fit in? What about what we call a zeitgeist or an artistic, humane, humanistic definition of the situation?
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of my mantras in the book that I keep repeating is that each age gets the thought it needs, that people tend to generate the kinds of ideas that the meanings of geography at that point in history are thrusting on them. And I think this is a very important point. That, historians, we do love to focus on the ideas, partly because these are what survive best in the literary record, partly because these are the kinds of things being generated by people in the past who are very like today's historians, you know, very highly educated people, very eloquent people with a great ability to get their ideas noticed. And these are the sorts of things that historians love to concentrate on. But one of the big things I found with writing on this very large scale about history was how different societies around the world have tended to come up with roughly the same solutions when faced by roughly the same questions. And so, like, if you go back to the first millennium BC, a time of a great thing, because guys like Socrates say, and a lot of the traditional stories about Western civ will put huge emphasis on Socrates and the importance of his ideas in ancient Athens. But if you look around on the old world and the big civilizations at roughly that time, the middle of the first millennium BC, you find thinkers in India and in China and in Persia and in Israel, all debating rather similar ideas to Socrates. All of these societies are being faced with rather similar problems and challenges. They are all, well, they're not coming up with exactly the same answers to them. This, I thought, was the really interesting thing. It's like geography and social development combined to force the same set of problems onto people. People are all over this region are debating what the answers are. Different answers receive different amounts of prominence in each part of the world, but the same range of answers keeps coming up. And this, I felt, is very much the picture throughout human history. And probably even more important for the topics I'm talking about in the book, be something like the scientific revolution in the 17th century. And of course, you know, giants like Newton and Descartes and so on in Europe, and Leibniz having all these, you know, spectacular breakthroughs, these brilliant ideas. And people will often assume, I mean, nowadays they tend to say it explicitly less, but will often assume, well, 17th century Europeans must have just been smarter than people anywhere else in the world. And I suggest in this book that this really wasn't the case, that the great thinkers of 17th century China and India are every bit as smart as the great thinkers of 17th century Europe. But they're focusing on slightly different questions, that geography is changing its meanings in the 16th and 17th centuries to thrust a whole new set of questions onto the Europeans. And the reason Europe has a scientific revolution is not because the Europeans are smarter or because Europeans are Christians or anything like that. It's simply that the changing meanings of geography are forcing Europeans to think harder about how nature works than anybody else in the world is thinking about it.
Ian Morris, come back to today with this old race of East and West as defined narrowing, but the whole world, it seems, approaching ceilings of energy consumption, for example, and conservation of the habitat. Bringing all of that new history and the old story of East and West into a manageable century focus today.
Yes, I think, I suggest in the book that The pluses from taking this huge look at history over such a long period is that there are two things we can do once we take in the big sweep of history. And one of them is that we can identify the trends that over the long term have driven the history of humanity. And particularly, I argue throughout the book, the changing meanings of geography are the big force who've been driving history along, determining which parts of the world are the richest and most productive and inventive parts of the world at a given point. So that's one of the things you can do, is you can look at these trends and kind of project them forward into the 21st century and ask yourself, you know, what will happen if the trends of the last few centuries continue operating across the next century? The other thing you can do, though, once you've identified what the big trends are and how they've been unfolding, you can also see how throughout history, the great trends of the great force of social development has tended to generate forces that undermine it at the same time. Hmm. You can also project that forward into the 21st century. Say, in addition to seeing where we would go if trends continued, we can also see what the forces are that might undermine these trends as we go forward into the next century. And the kind of alarming thing, I think, is that when you look back over the long run, there are periods in the history of the world when it stagnates and kind of gets stuck against ceilings and limits on what it's possible to do. And we even get some periods when we see social development falling and societies collapse into dark age type periods. And, you know, classic ones would be, say, the fall of the Roman Empire or the Han Dynasty in China, or, say, in the 14th century when the Black Death rages across Eurasia. And in each of these periods of collapse, we tend to see the same group of forces operating. And it involves things like very, very large-scale migrations. Uncontrollable migration is one of the things. Pandemic diseases spreading over huge areas, and which, of course, is very much linked to the large-scale migration. We see the collapse of states when governments are just unable to cope with these forces. And we see widespread famine or, say, shortage of water. We see all of these forces operating. And then every time we see a social collapse on a large scale, we see those four forces getting mixed up with a fifth horseman of the apocalypse, which is climate change. Mm. Climate change always works rather differently, but it's always there in the package when we see a great social collapse. And of course, anybody who reads a newspaper will know that these five forces are ones that people are constantly talking about in the early 21st century, that we seem to be seeing the same forces being released by rising social development that have been released over and over again in the past. And this, I think, is the sort of the big conclusion we can draw from looking at history, is seeing both where things might take us and what might undermine these trends.
And how does an historian confront four and now five horses of the apocalypse?
Yeah, well, I think we can learn a number of things from looking back across the last 15,000 years at how collapse has played out in different sorts of contexts. And I think one of the big things that we can learn is that in the past, when people like, say, in the later Roman Empire, the later period of the Han Dynasty in China, very often the leaders of society have just not even slightly understood the forces that are being arrayed against them. The Romans, say, really had very little understanding of the period of climate change that they were living through in the late empire, or the scale of migrations along the steppes that were pressing against the frontiers of the empire. They had very little understanding of how to deal with food shortages, and how to deal with the shortcomings and the mechanisms of state. Nowadays, I think we know a lot more about how these forces work. And I think one of the most important things is for us to grasp the kinds of forces that are driving changes in the distribution of power around the world. That in the past, like say when the Roman Empire is beginning to come undone, people in the Roman Empire have very little understanding of the way that geography is changing meanings and is just transforming the whole ballpark for the Roman Empire. I think now we're in a position that we really can say a lot more about this. And if we understand the way historical forces have played out, something like we've been seeing over the last 30 or 40 years, this great upsurge of wealth and power in East Asia, this really shouldn't have surprised anybody at all. This, I think, was entirely predictable as early as 150 years ago. It was entirely predictable. Some people did see it and did understand that wealth and power were flowing, first of all, across the Atlantic from Europe to North America, then across the Pacific from North America out to East Asia. And if we understand the great forces driving these sorts of changes, I think it makes it much less likely that we're going to panic and start doing really foolish things. Like, say, if you look back to 100 years ago, what people are doing in Western Europe when power is shifting toward North America, a lot of their decisions were very, very counterproductive. There's huge debate among historians on exactly what the causes of the world wars were. But clearly one of the big factors was this sense among Europeans that their grand strategic position was deteriorating, that wealth and power were moving across the Atlantic. North America was becoming a greater and greater force in the world. And this seems to have had quite a lot to do with the decisions to try to unify the continent of Europe by force that we see getting taken in the early and mid-20th century, setting off these world wars that, of course, have the exact opposite outcome. They force the Europeans to borrow so heavily to fight their wars that the only place it can go for the money is to North America. You know, the net effect of the world wars is to shift power outward from the old centres in Europe, out to North America, out to Eastern Europe, with the rise of the Soviet Union. And now, a lot of the rhetoric in the press now about the rise of East Asia is very, very similar to the rhetoric we saw 100 years ago about the rise of North America. And I think the great lesson we can learn here is not to confuse long-term forces with short-term fixes, not to start thinking the way a lot of Europeans were doing 100 years ago, that we can change the long-term geographical forces by going to war or by raising tariffs against imports. Clearly, this has not worked in the past, and I think there's no reason to think it's going to work in the 21st century either. That I think the challenge is to think you're going to change really deep-seated geographical forces which are kind of beyond the control of individual governments. The challenge is to learn how to work with these things and manage what's going on in the world.
Looking at the anxieties about China today, you can write off the manipulations of Chinese currencies as not a world-shaking historical problem. On the other hand, serious people do wonder if China can become a superpower without crossing lines that people are going to want to fight about.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of East Asia was underway long before people started worrying about the relative value of the yuan against different currencies. And getting China to revalue its currency, this is not going to stop the shift in wealth and power across the Pacific Ocean. And I don't think very many people seriously think that it will. But on the other hand, these are the sorts of things that do need to be managed very, very carefully as we see this global shift of power and influence underway. And one of the scary things when you look back across history is when you see the big shifts, when you see the great shift in power and wealth toward the West in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries and the rise of European imperialism, the bloodshed involved in that, the whole bucket of blood image for history here, the bloodshed involved in this is absolutely horrific. And when you see in the 20th century the great shift underway from Central and Western Europe out to North America in particular, again, the wars of the 20th century are far bloodier than any earlier wars. And these wars all came about through short-term miscalculations. I think there's nothing inevitable about the outbreak of the First or Second World War. These could well have been postponed. They could have well have been avoided altogether. And I think, say, if the First and Second World Wars had somehow been avoided altogether, and I think that would have been difficult to do, but it's certainly not impossible. And people had pulled off a rather similar feat in the 19th century, avoiding great European wars. If the wars had been put off, obviously, the world we live in today would be very different from the world that we actually do live in today. But I think in some of its big features, though, it wouldn't be as different as you might at first assume. That a lot of the forces that led to the breakdown of European imperialism would still have gone ahead even without the two world wars. European industrial power was already slipping before 1914 relative to the rise of American industrial power. And the European empires were finding it increasingly difficult to contend with the forces of nationalism in Asia and Africa, even without the outbreak of the world wars. The world wars, I think, speeded up the process. They bankrupted the European empires. They poured fuel onto the fires of nationalism in Asia and Africa. They enormously increased the rise of American power, and they speeded up the whole process. I think if we'd not had the world wars, Germany and Britain and France would be much more powerful in the world than they currently are. but their power would still have slipped enormously from where it stood 100 years ago. And so I think going forward into the 21st century, we're dealing probably with rather similar problems. That the challenge for the United States, I think, is how to manage the long-term, deep-seated strategic shifts toward East Asia without allowing them to trigger incidents that will spiral out of everybody's control. Because, of course, the real worry nowadays is that if we do have incidents like the ones in the 20th century that set off the world wars, now, because we have nuclear weapons, the scale of collapse that we can potentially bring on is so much bigger than any earlier collapse could possibly have been.
Ian Morris, take us to the convergence on your graph of East Asian power and the West. You say it happens in 2103. I'm braced.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one of the things you can do if, like me, you produce these graphs of social development and how this has changed over time, one of the things you can do is say, well, let's take some of these numbers and project them forward, to use history to be a kind of a guide to the future and say, what would the 21st century look like if, say, we were to take 20th century rates of increase in social development in the East and the West, project these forward, what will happen? And what you find is if you project the rate of 20th century increase forward, that the Eastern and Western scores meet in the year 2103. And so in one sense, I can say in my book, in 2103, Western rule will come to an end and the East will catch up. Because in saying that, I am being a bit silly. This is a slightly tongue-in-cheek prediction because there are so many variables involved in this. It is deeply unlikely that the year 2103 is going to be the exact point this will happen. And in fact, I think you can be pretty confident that what these graphs mean is that if we were able simply to project forward what we see in recent history, somewhere around the year 2100 is actually the latest point at which we should expect Eastern social development to catch up with Western. Because the experience over the last at least 500 years has been that the rate of increase in social development increases from century to century. It's accelerating. So probably what we can conclude from just projecting trends forward is that somewhere in the second half of the 21st century, Eastern social development will catch up with Western social development. And that, of course, is not a particularly outrageous or extreme prediction. A lot of people are saying things like this. But the other thing that I think we can do with the kind of approach I use in my book is to say, well, what will the world look like by that point, by the point that Eastern and Western social development converge? And because I've got this index that allows you to put some numbers on these things, some very interesting conclusions come out of this, that the amount of increase on the development index that we will see between now and the year 2103, this is roughly four times as much of an increase as we see between now and the end of the Ice Age. So like the distance in social development between the hunter-gatherers who painted the cave walls at Chauvet, say, between them and us is one quarter of what the index predicts for the gap between us and the point when East and West converge. And so I think the one thing we can be absolutely confident about is that predictions about the future that say, well, it's going to be basically like now, but shinier and faster and glitzier, and China will be richer. Those predictions are completely wrong. The 21st century is going to be utterly unlike anything that humanity has seen before. And in fact, I think it's not too much to suggest that the 21st century, the next 100 years are going to see more change than the last 100,000 years saw. Things are going to change out of all recognition.
The question arising from everything you say, is there anything at all we could do about it if we wanted to? You don't leave much room for inspiration, heroes, events, movements. If an age gets the ideas it needs, or if the biological process is going to unfold no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, I suggest at the end of my book that the changes we're looking at in the 21st century, these are really very like the kind of changes that evolutionary biologists deal with all the time. One way or another, I suggest that the human species is is going to change out of all recognition in the next 100 years. And one possibility is that social development does continue to rise at this extraordinary level. The kinds of processes we can already see going on around us, a kind of partial merging of biological human animals with the machines that they've created, these processes will accelerate. By the end of the 21st century, we will have merged carbon-based life forms with silicon-based forms in a way that now seems like utter science fiction, and that humanity will basically have ceased to be what we're familiar with. I think the other alternative we're looking at in the 21st century is that, thanks to the power of nuclear weapons, we will destroy ourselves completely. And once again, humanity will not be what we're used to dealing with. It'll going to be a very, very different thing after an all-out nuclear war. But one way or another, it seems to me that the pattern of history is implying that at some point in the relatively near future, we're going to see some kind of great evolutionary transformation, much like the ones that we can see in the earlier history of humanity. Either humans turn themselves into something else, the way they've done in the past through biological evolution over, and in the past, of course, over very, very long time periods. Thousands and thousands of years are required for biological evolution to make a huge difference. Or human beings are going to destroy themselves. The environment is going to turn against us either through the process of global climate change or through changing our environment dramatically through nuclear wars, various other possibilities we have open to us, in which case this particular branch on the evolutionary tree comes to a dead end also, much as has happened several times in the past. So I think that the 21st century, we are seeing another great evolutionary transformation. But thanks to the cultural evolution that humans have created, it's speeding up so much. It's going to happen on a very, very short time scale.
This suggests, and you have it in your book, the work of Ray Kurzweil and the singularity that is near when computing power approaches the complexity of the human brain and then infiltrates it. Ray Kurzweil's sort of tagline offer that if you'll just stick around for 20 years, he will have a better casing for your brain in silicon chips than you were given at birth, and that history proceeds in an entirely different way. Are we limited to these choices?
Well, yes. I mean, there's been a lot of thinking about what the pace of technological change implies for humanity. And yeah, I mean, Kurzweil has this lovely line he uses over and over again that he plans to live long enough to live forever. And his the thinking behind this is that if you plot out the rate of increase in computing power since, say, since the 1980s, you see this exponential growth in computing power. And we now know pretty accurately what the effectively the computing power of the human brain is from being able to do these neuron by neuron scans of the human brain. We have a pretty good sense of what its equivalent computing power is. And Kurzweil is able to predict that if this exponential increase in computer power carries on, then, gosh, if I get the dates right, I think he says by 2013 we'll be able to mimic the workings of human brain. By 2025 we will be effectively able to scan and load onto a silicon platform the workings of an entire human brain. And by 2045 we'll be able to upload all of the intelligence of humanity onto computer platforms. Now, of course, a lot of people think this is absolutely crazy. And my own feeling is that if you look at any specific predictions about the future, individual things are almost certainly going to be as wrong as, say, if you take 19th century predictions about what our world is like. And often they just seem very, very comical. But if you take those 19th century predictions, and if you look at lots of them, you do see the same broad ideas coming out of them. And on the whole, the broad ideas are not that far off. Some of the great trends that have shaped our own world. I tend to think the same will be true in the 21st century, that while Kurzweil's specific dates and the particular ways he or other futurists think about how humanity is going to change, these specifics are probably just going to seem comical 100 years from now. But the general picture of the merging of humanity with its machines, this, I suspect, is not going to seem so comical. And I suspect that partly because we can see so much of it happening already. That, say, if you wear eyeglasses, eyeglasses. You have, in a very small way, merged your biological body with man-made technologies. If you've got a pacemaker, you've done it even more so. There are some people who have had molecular-scale computers injected into their bloodstreams already to fight cancer in their blood. These are enzyme-based things that can glom onto the cancerous cells in your blood and destroy them. There are various agencies in the Department of Defense that are working on similar molecular scale computers that can be inserted into people's brains, which will give the brain something of the advantages of machine intelligence, allowing you to get a little bit like the kind of memory that we associate with our computers, the ability to have a completely accurate recall of things. In the more ambitious versions of this, these molecular scale computers in the brain would effectively give you internet access from your brain. And of course, the Department of Defense is hoping that soldiers will be able to deploy these skills on the battlefield, have sort of radio-less internet access between, you know, from the convenience of your own skull. And again, you know, all of this sounds absolutely crazy, except that the National Science Foundation did issue a report just a few years ago saying that they think that what they call network-enhanced telepathy is probably going to become a reality in the 2020s. And some scientists like to say that anything a scientist says, if you say that it's wrong, you're almost certainly wrong. The dates that the scientists give for their breakthroughs almost always come too soon. They're too optimistic. But pretty much all of the implications of the genetics and nanotechnology and robotics revolutions that people have talked about, all of them do seem to be coming true, albeit more slowly than the initial predictions suggested.
Ian Morris, the alternative vision of the future, which fascinates you and now me, is Isaac Asimov's imagination in a story called Nightfall of a planet where, for a variety of reasons, they have a total eclipse every 2,000 and some years.
Every 10,000 years.
Yeah, and they go nuts every time and destroy themselves and
yes,
then take another 10,000 years regenerating themselves. Do you want to put any money on that number?
Yes, the story is about a planet called Lagash. It has these multiple suns, which means it is always daylight on Lagash. But once every 10,000 years, the suns line up in a dead straight line, and one of the moons moves between Lagash and the suns. And night falls on Lagash. The stars come out. People go insane with fear and burn everything to the ground. Civilization has to start all over again. And throughout my book, I use this nightfall image. There's been a lot of points in history where people have liked to point at this and say, oh, nightfall, something like that happened to humanity. And in fact, nothing like nightfall has ever happened to humanity. There's been no sending us right back to the drawing board. But the great difference now is that we do have the potential to produce our own nightfall. That even if the Senate goes ahead in its wisdom and ratifies the latest rounds of arms reduction agreements, we still have enough nuclear weapons to kill everybody on Earth several times over. So I suggest in my book that the next 30 or 40 years are in some ways going to be the most important generation in the history of humanity. That I argue that the changing meanings of geography are kind of eradicating the meanings of geography as we go forward in the 21st century, that distance and space are meaning less and less. The world is becoming so much more unified. But you've got to be completely crazy to think this process has already reached its completion. There are still major differences in the world, major reasons why people in the next 30, 40, 50 years may decide that nuclear warfare is, say, the least bad of the options confronting them. So I think the next 30 or 40 years, we are going to be dealing with increasing pressures around the world to resort to extreme levels of violence. And the great threat to us, I think, is whether our leadership is able to rise above these challenges. I think that since World War II, for the first time, there have been people on Earth who have had the power to make a decision, as an individual decision that does absolutely change everything. That if Kennedy had panicked during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we would have not just had a different outcome, we would have fundamentally changed humanity. The face of the planet would be utterly different now. If we'd had a nuclear war in the 1980s, at that point when there was something like 10 times as many nuclear weapons out there as there are now, we could certainly have destroyed all of humanity if we'd wanted to. So this is the great challenge, I think, for humanity in the coming half century. And this, of course, is the thing that is most difficult to predict how it's going to turn out. And I'm generally an optimist. I think we'll muddle through this the way we've muddled through all kinds of problems in the past. But I would not want to bet too heavily on muddling through it.
Ian Morris, you've given us a sermon and a kind of political warning with 20,000 years of the new history behind it. I'm not sure I accept your definition of us as clever chimps, but I'm staggered by your learning. Thank you, Ian Morris, for the boldness of this book, Why the West Rules for Now, and thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. This has been a lot of fun.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.